Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of whether there will be a war with Iran or whether diplomacy will be revived to avert one. Gary Sick, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis, joins us. We will discuss Hillary Clinton's condemnation and emphatic denial of U.S. involvement in the assassination of an Iranian scientist that appears to be an effort to derail talks underway in Turkey between U.S. and Iranian diplomats. Then we will look into the setback in Oklahoma for proponents of a ban on Sharia law in the United States, even though there is a total lack of evidence that anybody is planning or proposing to impose Sharia law on anyone. Faz Shakir, a vice president at the Center for American Progress, joins us to discuss the casual anti-Muslim bigotry in this country that Fox News inflames and the Republican Party seems to tolerate, if not endorse. Then finally, we're joined in the studio by the award-winning filmmaker Joe Berlinger, whose latest documentary feature, Paradise Lost 3, Purgatory, premieres tonight, Thursday, on HBO. We will talk about the appalling miscarriage of justice the film documents and the bittersweet happy ending with the filmmaker and with one of the so-called West Memphis Three, Jason Baldwin, who also joins us to tell his inspiring personal story of enduring 18 years of imprisonment for a crime he did not commit. Joining us now is Gary Sick, who's a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute, and he also teaches in Columbia's School for International Public Affairs. He's the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran and the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan, and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. He's a retired U.S. Navy captain with service in the Persian Gulf, North Africa, and the Mediterranean, and was a deputy director for the international affairs at the Ford Foundation from 1982 to 1987, where he's responsible for programs relating to U.S. foreign policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gary Sick.
Thank you, Ian.
And clearly something happened yesterday with the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton making public remarks about the assassination of the Iranian scientist by a magnetic car bomb in the traffic in Tehran. She seemed to publicly want to distance herself from this act, which most fingers point to Israel, and she said, we both condemn it and we had nothing to do with it. Now, whether the Iranians will believe that's another thing, but it seemed to me to be an interesting development. You get the feeling that behind the scenes, the Obama administration is trying to distance themselves from Israel.
I thought this was a remarkable statement because I don't think this message was so much aimed at Iran, though obviously that was who it was directed to officially. I thought it was a message directed primarily to Israel. And I think it's not unfair to read into the secretary's comments that she was a little, annoyed about the fact that we were just getting ready to have talks with Iran in Turkey, that we had had the Undersecretary of State over there discussing possible talks, and he no sooner left the room than Mr. Larijani, the Speaker of the Majlis, showed up from Iran, and clearly things were coming to a head, and they're getting ready for some kind of discussion, serious negotiations, and at that point there's this car bomb that goes off and assassinates a leading scientist. That was clearly not helpful to the negotiations, and this is the first time when we've had one of these mysterious events in Tehran that the United States has said they really had nothing to do with this and made it absolutely clear that this was not the U.S. doing, which usually they don't do that in cases of unexplained developments. And secondly, seriously denouncing it. She didn't say that it was an act of terrorism, but she certainly distanced herself from such activities. Of course, the United States has its own susceptibilities here. I mean, we've been conducting assassinations too, so I guess she can't go too far. But it looked to me as if she had very clearly set her direction, her strategy, toward some kind of negotiation with Iran This was not helpful, and she was trying to put it back on the rails again.
And Gary Sick, we have to sort of put this in the context, I think, of the bill that the president signed on New Year's Eve, that he threatened to veto the NDAA, where McCain and Lindsey Graham and other Republicans tried to force his hand on putting the screws to Iran in terms of their central bank. He was worried that that would raise the price of oil, and obviously high oil prices in an election year are not good for the incumbent. So
well, there's another aspect of this. You know, that in a way, that piece of legislation that the Congress passed with overwhelming support, basically designed to bring down the central bank of Iran. I mean, that was the objective in the name of sanctions. But in fact, a lot of people were warning at the time this was being discussed that in stopping a sort of financial blockade of Iran isn't really that different from a military blockade, and that's an act of war.
So this is a two-track policy, because given that today Japan said it would take concrete steps to reduce its oil dependency on Iran, that's the second biggest customer. Obviously, behind the scenes, the Saudis and others are pledging to make up the shortfall. I believe that we put the screws on India as well. They didn't agree. So on the one hand, we are going ahead with these sanctions, but on the other hand, we're having talks, which it looks as though an effort was made to scuttle those talks by the assassination of the Iranian diplomat. When we talk about diplomacy, do you believe that when he first came into office, that President Obama did appear to reach out to Iran? Some people said not enough. Others said that he basically found it a waste of time. How invested is this regime? Because in Iran, you essentially have no left or center left. You've only got two right-wing factions fighting each other. And I don't believe that the notion of the embers burning under the ashes. I think that this is a regime in many ways that is invested in the great Satan. So give me your analysis of, the,
yeah,
of that.
Iran and the United States have each actually been following similar paths, similar strategies. Both have been, in the case of the United States, it's pressure, more and more sanctions on Iran. And the ostensible reason for that pressure is to get Iran to the negotiating table, to get them to talk and to actually change their program of nuclear development. Iran, on the other hand, has used a policy of threats and outspoken denunciations, again, with the idea, always coupled with the idea that we are prepared to talk about this without preconditions. I think what's happened is that the pressure tactics on the part of the United States and Iran have actually escalated to the point where each side had to sort of peer over the brink and look at the abyss underneath, and both sides have decided to pull back a little bit and perhaps pursue a less risky policy. In other words, actually do what they said they were going to do. They said they wanted pressure to lead to negotiations. Well, the pressure has gotten very, very intense with no sign of negotiations. And now, if in fact what we're seeing is a move to some kind of negotiated settlement, or at least negotiations, that is quite, that's very much what they said they were trying to do. I just think that it got too close for comfort in terms of the danger of actually escalating into a war that absolutely no one in the United States or in Iran wants. They know that no good can possibly come of this, and that this is something to be avoided at all costs. President Obama, if he does in fact open up talks with Iran and they don't produce miracles, which they never do, it's going to take a lot of heat from the Republicans that he is wimping out, that he is being soft on Iran, and that he's being taken for a ride. The alternative would be to let things ride, and maybe if the sanctions go into effect and Iran's oil is cut off, to go to an actual shooting war, which would be far worse than getting him than being attacked by the Republicans for foreign policy. So I think this administration feels fairly confident of its position on foreign policy in dealing with the Republican challenge. And it's got, Osama bin Laden and a number of other achievements, two wars winding down. that they think they can defend themselves. And this, I think, it becomes a really serious matter for the administration to try to deal with. How do you wind down this escalating hyperbole that we have seen over the past several years, leading to a position that, in fact, could make both sides end up in a war that they absolutely do not want to do? And I think, if I'm correct, that's what's happening right now with Obama and in Tehran as well, that it's not because they love each other suddenly. It's because both of them realize that if left untended, this problem could, in fact, burn both of them very badly.
So if there are some adults in the room, Gary Sick, on the other hand, you've got these wild cards out there. You've got, first of all, you've got a naval exercise Iran's doing next month. You've got the joint Israeli-American exercises designed to blunt a Hezbollah rocket barrage, which would be the retaliation in asymmetrical warfare that the Iranians would employ, that austere Challenge 12. Those two exercises could clash. You've got lots of indications from Israel, from the senior defense and intelligence officials, that they don't trust Netanyahu and they think he's bent on attacking Iran. How much could this get out of hand, given that all the Republican candidates in these debates are literally stepping over each other to be the first to bomb Iran? My fear is that that this already could be in the arena of electoral politics, and that we know that Netanyahu and the Republicans are very tight, and Netanyahu has almost disdain for President Obama. What about that wild card?
Well, I don't think that's a wild card. I think that is the realities of politics in the United States right now. And from my perspective, as someone who has argued for years that, in fact, diplomacy needed to be given a fair shake, I'm among those who feel that Obama came in with good intentions, but then really didn't follow through. He made a couple of gestures toward Iran. When it didn't work out perfectly right away, he walked away from it and has gone the pressure track ever since that time. I think that basically the negotiating track should have been tended to more carefully up until now. But to be fair to Obama and to his administration, Iran went through the 2009 election problems. You had massive marches in the streets, tremendous crackdowns and abuses of human rights and civil rights. And under those circumstances, it was really very difficult for the Obama administration to actually open up and show any signs of trust in this regime. And it's also was difficult for anybody in Tehran to respond to any genuine overtures. That seems to have changed. Both sides now, as I say, seem to have looked at the possible effects of their policies, and they don't like what they see. It's really very dangerous, and they've decided to forget about the niceties of this and to forget about their qualms earlier and to go back and see what they can do. I may be ahead of it here. It may be that, in fact, the negotiating track won't get off the ground. But the signs look quite promising. The foreign minister of Iran formally announced that they were open for negotiation. They were prepared to go back to the negotiating track. And he said it in a very unequivocal way. Hillary Clinton, just 2 days ago, in responding to Iran's announcement of opening up this new uranium enrichment site, denounced the site, but then went on to say very firmly that she was pushing the idea of negotiations, and that they were going back to the negotiating table. The Undersecretary of State has gone to Turkey to talk about how to set up talks there with Iran. The Speaker of the Majlis in Iran has showed up in Turkey right after him. And it's clear that there's something seriously going on here. That doesn't mean that the problem's going to be resolved overnight. This is a tough problem.
Sure.
And any negotiations would be difficult. But it looks as if both sides have decided that it's worth taking the risk, even though they will pay a high political price for it.
Well, the fact that the speaker, who's Akhmadinejad's rival, showed up is an interesting development in itself. But I mentioned earlier that it seems to be Iranian politics are now a struggle between the two right-wing religious factions, that the center and the left was pretty much squashed in the Green Revolution. That they.
But Larijani, who was the guy who went to Turkey, is a close advisor to the Supreme Leader.
Supreme Leader, of course. And a rival of Ahmadinejad.
He is a rival to Ahmadinejad. And in fact, that he represents the dominant political force in Iran. We may not like those people, and we may not like the way they're running the country, but they are the ones running the country.
Sure.
And if you want to do a deal, they're really the only people to talk to right now.
Well, also, I think in these debates, what Romney is saying is absolutely absurd, that if Obama dropped the ball and didn't support the Green Revolution. I mean, had the United States overtly supported the Green Revolution, they would have been extinguished quicker because they were trying to blame everything on the CIA in any case. Just in closing, though, Gary Sick, getting back to what concerns me about electoral politics, meddling in foreign affairs and the incumbent president being blindsided by amateurs or whatever. There's a couple of incidents in our history. One, when Johnson was trying to make a peace deal with the North Vietnamese, Kissinger, and through the offices of Madam Chiang Kai-shek, convinced the South Vietnamese to walk out on the peace talks, which helped the election of Nixon and sealed the fate of Humphrey to some extent. You explored the October surprise scenario in your book, October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran, and the election of Ronald Reagan. Is there a possibility of that kind of meddling happening here in league with Netanyahu, who seems to be, as I mentioned earlier, very much in sync with the Republicans?
Well, that's an extreme scenario. I never underestimate politicians in terms of what they're capable of doing in self-defense or basically to preserve what they see as an opening or a victory. In the other two cases, the forces that wanted to upset things developed or had good contacts with the people on the other side that they needed help from, that is, from the South Vietnamese and from the case of the Iranians, that Bill Casey had developed covert contacts to try to cut a deal with them. It's a little difficult for me right now to see the Republicans, with or without the Israelis, making common cause with the hardline right-wing Iranians, the theocrats, to try to prevent Obama from winning the election.
But that's not what I'm saying, Gary Sig. I'm saying that if Israel were to attack unilaterally and Obama didn't approve it, and apparently he's already let them know that he doesn't approve of that idea, wouldn't he be isolated? And at the very least, the price of oil would go through the roof.
Well, the price of oil would go through the roof. And basically, you have to look at what would happen. If Israel attacked unilaterally, one, they wouldn't solve the problem. They couldn't, in fact, defeat the Iranian nuclear program. It would go underground. It would become more threatening than it had been. They would confirm this hardline group in office because people would rally around the flag. The price of oil would absolutely go to extraordinary levels, having an impact on every developing economy in the world and all of those economies trying to come out of the recession. And in return, it would hurt Obama enormously because of the price of oil and giving him a thing. But, you know, Israel really does depend on its relationship with the United States. And I'm not so much concerned about Obama's reaction, but I'm looking at the way Hillary Clinton responded the other day. It looks to me as if there would be a fairly tough response on the part of the United States if we saw ourselves being dragged into a third Middle East war against our will. And I think the American people, who really are not enthusiastic about such a thing, would have real serious thoughts. So I think that any Israeli, you know, prime minister who is thinking about launching a unilateral attack that would drag the United States into another Middle East war would have to at least take into consideration the effect that that might have on U.S.-Israeli relations, which is absolutely, if you want to look at existential politics for Israel, the United States is existential. I mean, our position. So creating a massive crisis with the United States would at least be a very high-risk effort, and it could backfire enormously.
Well, Gary Sick, I don't mean to be conspiratorial, but I think it's worth exploring these possibilities.
I do, too.
Because we have a very incendiary mix going on there now. And I thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure, as always. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Gary Sick, who's a senior research scholar at Columbia University's Middle East Institute. He teaches in Columbia School of International and Public Affairs and is the author of All Fall Down, America's Tragic Encounter with Iran, and October Surprise, America's Hostages in Iran in the Election of Ronald Reagan. He served on the National Security Council under Presidents Ford, Carter, and Reagan and was the principal White House aide for Iran during the Iranian Revolution and the hostage crisis. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the set backs for banning Sharia law in Oklahoma.
Scroll messages, victims and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept, you know.
Bruce Brother!
Sit down, man.
Glenn Beck!
Sit down, man.
Rand Paul!
Sit down, man.
Netanyahu!
Sit down, man.
Sarah Palin!
Sit down, man.
Newt Gingrich!
Sit down, man.
Toby Keith!
Sit down, man.
Billy Shapley.
Sit down, man.
Bloomberg.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Faz Shakir, a vice president at American Progress, and he serves as editor-in-chief of thinkprogress.org and the Progress Report. He previously worked as a research associate for the Democratic National Committee and as a legislative aide to Senator Bob Graham on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee and as a communication aide in the White House Office of National Drug Policy. And he's the co-author of Howard Dean's Prescription for Real Healthcare Reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Faz Shakir.
Thank you for having me.
And what's going on in Oklahoma now? This is, it's a bizarre situation that there's this sort of jihad going on in the United States against the imposition of Sharia law, when there's absolutely zero evidence that Sharia law is in any way emerging as even a possibility in our country, in our courts, and in our culture. Yet, nevertheless, by I think a 70% majority, the citizens of Oklahoma approved State Question 755 in 2010. Where does it stand now with the Federal Appeals Court ruling?
Well, what just happened is that there was the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals who ruled that that Sharia ban is unconstitutional. And the reason it's unconstitutional is, of course, that it's a violation of the First Amendment on the grounds that it is establishing one religion over another. And it is preventing the free exercise of Muslims. And I think the big fault of the creators of this particular Oklahoma Sharia amendment was that they actually used the words Sharia and made clear that their intentions were to bash Muslims who practice their faith. For people who aren't aware of what Sharia is, it's largely a kind of code and a type of practice that governs the way in which Muslims live their lives, everything from dress to what they eat and how they choose to conduct their marriage ceremonies. It's largely just a bunch of religious practices. And Oklahoma was trying to do was suggest that any time that Sharia is considered in a U.S. court, it would be criminalized. The problem there, as you mentioned, is and as the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled, that they could find no evidence that Sharia has ever been considered in the courts in Oklahoma or would be considered in the courts, because there is a provision in the Constitution, particularly, namely, the Supremacy Clause, which says that the supreme law of the land is the Constitution and supersedes all other laws. And you don't need any other language other than that. And so this whole exercise against Sharia is really just kind of a campaign to make people fearful and hateful towards Muslims.
So the Federal Appeals Court in Denver upheld the U.S. District Court's overturning of this amendment to the Oklahoma Constitution, voted in on question 755 by a 70% majority of citizens of Oklahoma, or voters of Oklahoma, I should say. What I find extraordinary in the United States and in our politics at the moment, Fashakir, is the casual racist, anti-Muslim bigotry that goes unchallenged. I mean, this law itself is ludicrous and is rooted in bigotry. During the Republican debates, Herman Cain, one of the candidates, made racist, anti-Muslim remarks and said he wouldn't have a Muslim in his cabinet. This goes unchallenged. So why is it that it goes unchallenged, and who should be challenging this?
It's very popular in Republican ranks to bash Muslims, and it works out quite well for them. Their base of the Republican Party seems to appreciate this kind of hate mongering, and there's a lot of reasons for why that might be. I think one of which is that they've pitted this as kind of a war of civilizations, that somehow Muslim values are incompatible with Western values, and I think it's obviously completely false. And there are many wonderful Muslim Americans living in the United States and abiding by U.S. laws and totally assimilating into America and bringing their wonderful customs and foods and all and trust to share with us and as we share with them. And that's the way humanity, of course, should operate. But what the Republicans are doing is suggesting that Muslim values are a threat and are incompatible. And I think one of the worst examples of this is Newt Gingrich, who is the only candidate who has suggested that he would like to propose a federal anti-Sharia law, and not just a state law, but a federal law. And, you know, there's a possibility, of course, that he could win South Carolina and carry the GOP nomination. Mitt Romney, the leading contender of the Republican side, has said explicitly in a Republican debate that there is no concern that Sharia law will be practiced in American courts. So at least he's been honest about that. I think as you see this play out, the reason that many Republicans like to talk about their fear of Muslims, and it's manifested in a number of different ways. One is, of course, let's bomb Iran because there are a lot of crazy Muslims in charge in their government, or let's keep Gitmo open and continue to detain people indefinitely in Guantanamo Bay, and that, you know, partly that's again a reason to make people fearful of Islam, and it seems to be the orchestrating foreign policy theory that as long as you can say something about how fearful Muslims are, then you can sound credible, and the media, quite frankly, hasn't done a great job of trying to push back on some of the greatest misconceptions about Islam, mostly because I think they don't quite understand it. Many people, according to a recent Brookings poll, only 3 in 10 Americans have any casual interaction with Muslims over the past year. So this is kind of a religion in a peoples who aren't familiar to America, and for that reason, we have a knowledge gap, I think, on the issue.
Well, if you were to make a bigoted anti-African-American or anti-Latino remark, you'd be pulled over by the press and by, I think, even by your own political party, wouldn't you?
Oh, absolutely. And we've seen that happen a number of times where you have people apologizing for sounding racist with respect to African-Americans or even Latinos, even though there's probably a little more leeway to sound racial in the Latino context as long as you're talking about border security or something along those lines. But you're right that, like, if you can get away with saying the most egregious things about Muslims, brown-skinned people, because there just isn't as much of a strong political appetite to defend it, unfortunately. And we saw this during the Ground Zero mosque, the quote-unquote Ground Zero mosque controversy, when President Obama initially tried to defend the right of Muslims to construct that house of worship. And many Democrats weren't even actually willing to stake the same position as President Obama. And in fact, the loudest voices were Republicans who were saying that they were constructing a victory mosque, and this is a victory for all terrorists, and that all of the Muslims who would go to this mosque are clearly terrorist-sympathizing Muslims. There's, you know, just very terrible kinds of insinuations.
Well, that was Fox News for several months, wasn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. Fox News has been the leader, and of course, this anti-Muslim hate plays very well on what I call hate radio. So the Rush Limbaughs and the Michael Savages and Sean Hannity's, you know, those guys, and then Andrew McCarthy at the National Review, the Weekly Standard, you know, the World Net Daily, all the kind of places that tend to get a lot of conservative traffic. Andrew Breitbart's various sites on right-wing sites. So all of those traffic and the worst kinds of anti-Muslim hate, and many of them stem from the same common people. There's an Islamophobia network on the right. Some of those individuals include Robert Spencer, who leads a blog called Jihad Watch, Frank Gaffney, who's the head of the Center for Security Policy, and that's always sounding alarms about Muslim Brotherhood infiltration of the United States. These kind of people are the ones who are often quoted and they kind of serve as an echo chamber unto themselves.
So given that we're condoning bigotry as a culture, both in the media and in our politics, particularly on the Republican side, has anybody pointed out, though, let's not go to the moral aspects of it, let's just deal with practical national security issues. If we are in a so-called war on terror, the only people that can dissuade radical Islamists from becoming radicals are moderate Islamists. So in an intelligent and reasonable world, in order to fight terrorism, as it's called, wouldn't it mean that you really have to nurture moderate Islam, which is what American Muslims are? They're living in a pluralistic society. They're living examples of Islam being compatible with democracy and pluralism. Who's nurturing that logical buttress to this exaggerated war on terror?
Right. Well, that's one of the problems, is that you don't see it very often articulated by political leaders. I think President Obama does understand it. I think he's shared that kind of philosophy at times and believes it, but I don't think that there are a ton of people who are standing in line behind them willing to amplify that kind of argument in the political context, because most of what politicians have learned is that any time you try to defend Muslims, then you just basically get unfairly smeared and attacked for being too sympathetic towards terrorists. But your general argument is, of course, correct, and it is one that the administration has argued, which is that your best allies in fighting radical extremists of the Muslim faith are moderate Muslims themselves. According to a Muslim Public Affairs Council study, they said that of all the al-Qaeda plots that have been foiled in the United States, or al-Qaeda-linked plots that have been foiled in the United States, one-third of them have been foiled because we got a tip from a member of the Muslim community. And I think that this has played itself out a number of times, including in the quote-unquote Times Square bomber, who had tried to set off a car bomb there. It was reported by a Senegalese Muslim vendor. And so that's one of the reasons why you don't want to ostracize all Muslims. They are, of course, a key ally in this fight, and it's important to make them feel like they are part of the American fabric and part of the American community, because they certainly are. Another reason to not engage in this kind of hateful fear-mongering is that it bolsters our enemies. It strengthens the al-Qaedas of the world. If they're able to say, look, the West is at war with us, come and join our cause, come be a terrorist radical in our ranks. If the Hezbollahs and Hamases can say things like that, all they need to do is see some of the language being espoused by right-wing actors here in America who are trying to engage in these kinds of wars, stealth wars against Islam. And so I think we would all be benefited from kind of ratcheting down the rhetoric and being a little bit more thoughtful and a lot less antagonistic.
Again, I'm speaking with Faz Shakir, who's vice president at the Center for American Progress and serves as editor-in-chief of thinkprogress.org and the Progress Report. Well, I recall, Faz, that when Lou Dobbs was on CNN and spouting all kinds of anti-Latino bigotry, a lot of Latino organizations got together and shamed CNN into firing him. And I'm just wondering why there isn't a coalition of groups in this country, faith-based groups, and the Democratic Party, for that matter, because the Republican Party is apparently a bigotry-free zone when it comes to Muslims. Why isn't this being organized, and why not this pushback?
Well, I think you're starting to see it. I mean, it's in its infancy, but what has happened because of Peter King, Representative Peter King's congressional hearings into Muslim radicalization, and this occurred last year, I think last March, it really started to move people both within the Muslim community and outside of it to say, oh, we need to start forming coalitions and working together, those of us who have never worked together before. So this is joining of it across a lot of faiths and across a lot of issue areas and saying, hey, we have a common fight here. We're trying to defend our civil rights, civil liberties as a country and try to push back on people who want to make this a place of hate. And so I think you saw that in the pushback to Peter King's hearings, and I think that you've had a number of victories since then. And one that pops to mind is the fallout over the decision by Lowe's, the hardware giant, to pull its advertising from a Muslim show on TLC called All American Muslim. I think that when Lowe's decided to pull its advertising because it decided to cave to a right-wing group who was upset that the Muslim show, reality show, wasn't showing a terrorist, Lowe's decided, okay, we'll cave to that pressure and pull our advertising. What happened is you saw a national movement of people who both wanted to boycott TLC, but also Lowe's. And also wanted to engage in positive efforts to buy advertising on All American Muslim. And so there was a glimmer of hope there. I think also that you see that the currency of Islamophobia is gaining a little bit less traction than it used to, and I hope that's a sign that we're moving in a positive direction.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Faz Shakir.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Again, I've been speaking with Faz Shakir, who's a vice president at the Center for American Progress, and he serves as editor-in-chief of thinkprogress.org and the Progress Report. He previously worked as a research associate for the Democratic National Committee as a legislative aide to Senator Bob Graham on the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee and as a communications aide in the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back in a moment, joined by a filmmaker and an extraordinary and inspiring young man who spent 18 years wrongly imprisoned in Arkansas. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining me in the studio is Joe Berlinger, who, along with Bruce Sanofsky, are a team of American documentary filmmakers who gained critical acclaim and cult fame since their debut crime film, Brother's Keeper. Their latest film, Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory, will premiere on HBO Thursday night. It is the third film in a series originally intended to be a movie about three guilty teenagers on trial for murder. Sarnowski and Burlingame soon realized that their film Paradise Lost, which chronicled the murder of 3 8-year-old boys in rural Arkansas, eventually became more about the fear and panic of Satanism along with questionable police work that led to the arrest and conviction of 3 teenagers known as the West Memphis Three. Burlingame and Sarnowski also made the film on the rock band Metallica, Some Kind of Monster, and Joe Burlingame directed the feature documentary Crude. And also joining us in the studio is Jason Baldwin, one of the West Memphis Three. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, glad to be here.
And beginning with you, Joe, this has been 20 years of your life, Jason, in jail.
Right.
But it's also, for a filmmaker, it's been very unusual.
It's been 2 decades.
Two decades.
Yeah. And you know, as you mentioned in your intro, we were sent an article right after these guys were arrested by Sheila Nevins at HBO, and the article, you know, we didn't realize at the time just how one-sided the press reports coming out of Arkansas were, and it just seemed like an open and shut case, according to the press, of bad guys, you know, horrible teenagers worshiping the devil, killing 3 8-year-olds. And one of the great ironies of this 2-decade, 3-film odyssey of advocating for their release and their innocence is that we went down to Arkansas back in June of 93, a few days after the arrest, thinking we were making a film about bad guys, you know, kind of a real life River's Edge, that 1986 movie by Tim Hunter about, you know, disaffected youth. And you know, the first couple of months we were down there, we primarily spent with the parents of the victims, had no reason necessarily to believe that we still weren't making a film about guilty teenagers. But the moment we met these guys and did our first interviews, just, you know, red flags started going up. And we realized that these guys, we came to realize, I can't say it was like an immediate, oh my God, because that would be irresponsible to just make a decision like that. But it just didn't seem that these guys had committed the crime. And the more we dug into it, the more we realized that this was, you know, a rush to judgment and that these guys were innocent.
Well, Jason Baldwin, you were arrested as a teenager.
Right. I was 16 years old, and they arrested me on my last day of school for the 10th grade.
And you came out as a 35-year-old man, is that right?
In April, I'll be 35, yeah. Close enough, right?
That's a lot of time and obviously a deep injustice. And, of course, the bitter irony was that in order for you to get out of jail, you had to plead guilty to a crime for which you were innocent.
Right. They said I can maintain my innocence and keep standing on that, but at the same time, I had to accept the state's assertion that they have guilty people,
right?
Which really doesn't make sense at all, no matter how you look at it. But it was the only opportunity I was presented with to save Damien's life for certain, you know, to get him off death row in that horrible, horrible place he was in. Of course, where I was at wasn't a picnic either, but it wasn't nearly as bad as where he was.
Right, and it foreclosed the possibility of a trial at which the state knew you'd be acquitted,
exactly.
And then you'd be able to turn around and sue them for damages for
Correct.
Taking so many years off your life.
Right. Yeah, I think that was their main line of reasoning, which I can understand them wanting to save the state money for upcoming hearings and a possible trial and wanting to get a quick, finally, a quick, you know, ending to all this. However, what I don't understand is the fact that they made us take the Alford plea. What they should have done is dropped all charges, said, you know, it was erroneous from the start. We had new people in power, you know, Scott Englund, new judge, David Lacer. So wouldn't any fault and blame be on them. However, they still had the looming, had to deal with the contention of a lawsuit for false imprisonment. So I think that was the only thing that they were being permitted to pursue. But it flies in the face of, you know, their oaths as public servants, you know, to uphold the law and protect justice and the innocent. And this deal did not do that in any way, because it leaves the case closed for finding who really murdered those boys. And that's the true tragedy.
And does anyone, you know, it's just illogical. Does anyone really think that the state of Arkansas, that these officials would, if they really in their hearts believed that these 3 teenagers took 3 8-year-olds out into the woods and slaughtered them in a devil-worshipping ritual, as they allege, does anyone really think that they would release them, you know, vacate the death penalty sentence, vacate the life without parole sentence, and release them if they really believe that they were guilty. And if they really do believe that they're guilty and they release them under those circumstances, shame on the state of Arkansas. But I say shame on the state of Arkansas for making these guys plead guilty to a crime that they didn't commit just to end this nightmare of 18 years of false imprisonment.
And just apropos the idea that the guilty person is still out there, the film makes a fairly strong case that there is somebody that is very likely to be guilty. In the DNA evidence that was exculpatory, there was a hair found on the bindings on the boys that traced to the stepfather of one of the murdered boys.
Yeah.
And you've gotten amazing footage that you've been able to show us of him being deposed in a different matter where he actually sued one of the Dixie Chicks, right? So walk
strange,
us through that.
Strange. Well, you know, I would hate to do to Mr. Hobbs, who's the stepfather of murder victim Stephen Branch, I would hate to do to him what was done to the West Memphis Three and definitively say, oh, he's the killer. You know, there was – the point of that in the film is that there's extremely exculpatory – all the DNA evidence points away from the West Memphis Three. Not a shred of DNA has been found linking these guys to the crime. And in a crime as grisly as this, as they allege – you would think that there would be DNA somewhere. The one piece of DNA is a hair that was found in the ligature, in the shoelace, you know, because these boys were bound hand to foot, you know, in a hog-tied fashion. In the ligature of one of the boys' shoelaces, Michael Moore, was found a hair consistent with Terry Hobbs, but also consistent with 1.5% of the population. So it's not open and shut definitive proof, but the point of it is that in this country, when people are convicted of a capital crime, which means death row or life without parole, the measure of the law, the jury is instructed to find that verdict beyond all reasonable doubt. And when you have such alarming DNA evidence that points to somebody else and points away from the West Memphis Three, that is something that needs to be looked into. And of course, with this Alford plea, the state is officially saying the case is closed, that the guilty people have served time, and that is an affront to anybody who's interested in justice, and particularly an affront to the parents of the victims who are being told we're not going to find who the real killer is.
But it also points, surely, Joe Burlinger, to the notion that the police work was so poor in the first place to have arrived at this railroaded verdict. And they didn't bother to look into this guy who had a violent past.
Oh, my God.
And he shot his brother-in-law or somebody, didn't he?
There was an altercation with his brother that resulted in a stomach wound that ended up killing the, you know, killing the brother.
That's not an everyday
right? No, of course not. I mean, you know, statistically, child homicides are overwhelmingly done by parents or guardians or somebody who knew the child very well. That is just a statistical fact. And so therefore, the police not even interviewing this stepfather at the time of the arrests, or at the time of the crimes, rather, is just emblematic of the tunnel vision they had. You know, Damien Echols, you know, was a different kid. He wore a long black trench coat in the summer, allegedly, and the juvenile officers were already sending his drawings and writings to a bogus satanic expert a year before the crimes even took place. I mean, they had it in. They were going to find a crime to pin on this guy. And unfortunately, Jason was friends with Damien, and so it was guilt by association. But it does. It's, you know, the police work in this case was shockingly inferior.
And tell me, though, Joe Bellinger, it's not explicit in the film in any way, but it's just something that I felt about the film, about the atmospherics, is that the leap to Satanism, you know, when in fact the bodies of these boys were mauled by animals in the forest, which is incredibly common when they find bodies, you know, that the foxes and the coyotes and whatever have mauled them. That's, you know, you see these CSI films on TV, it's half the time it's about that. So that's amazing that that never occurred to the prosecutors and the police. But the Satanism with that bogus mail-ordered PhD guy, is that fueled by kind of Christian fundamentalism, which is, I think, pretty prevalent in Arkansas is a red state?
Yeah.
So give me a sense of whether there is that sort of sense of piety there that drove this kind of delusion.
Well, you know, being a New York Jew, I don't want to bust on Christians here, but, you know, I think it's a little more complex than that, in the sense that this entire country had, in the late 80s, early 90s, was swept up in this satanic hysteria. The media was inflaming it. You see it in the film. There was a 2020 news article, and it showed a map about, not article, broadcast, you know, the Satan expert, you know, shows us his interview back in 1985, and there's a map about all these different states. But the reality is the FBI in 92 said, you know, we cannot connect a single homicide, a single child homicide with satanic activity, and that this is just a bogus thing that police experts who then go advise police departments are just making hay off of, you know, earning a living and creating this fake hysteria. So I think this was a nationally prevalent thing, but I think where the Christian fundamentalism comes in, and with all due respect to that region, I think this was a part of the world where, first of all, people, you know, if you literally believe in heaven and hell, and if you believe in Jesus, then and you believe in the devil, and therefore I think people felt that it was, this crazy story was plausible. But I don't even, you know, I don't want to make it a religious thing, because I think the other thing that I observed down there in this part of the world, you know, I think people in Arkansas and other places, you know, believed in their authority figures. They have no reason to question the police. And so when the police come out and say, on a scale of 1 to 10, it's an 11, and when the prosecution, you know, comes out and portrays this crazy devil-worshipping theory, the people there are, as they should, you know, unfortunately, they violated the trust that was placed in them by having this crazy story. I think the combination of religious fundamentalism and the goodness of the Arkansas people who believe in their authority figures led them to buy into this story, not to mention the local media there. And that's one of the themes of this third film, because you actually see the local media reports throughout the film. The local media in the early days of this story did everything possible to inflame people's passions. They printed a confession that was completely out of context, a false confession, as we later learn, there was no way these guys were going to get a fair trial. So the combination of the media reporting the story, people believing in their authority figures, and believing in the devil as a tangible thing, I think did help make this a reality for people.
Well, it also feels, though, that, you know, anti-intellectualism played a role here. If you had to follow the logic of the trial judge, who, when the lawyers challenged the credibility of this satanic expert who's got a mail order PhD, when they say, well, this guy, you know, ask him, understand, did you sit for any courses to get your PhD? No. And then the judge intervenes and says, well, you know, you don't have to really go to school to be an expert, you know.
Well, I mean, you could have a third grade education.
Yeah, I was astounded by that.
Look, we, you know, we sat through those trials with our jaws on the ground most of the time, because we saw these guys were absolutely getting railroaded, and their musical tastes and their, their religious beliefs were on trial. I mean, Metallica lyrics were actually introduced into the trial as evidence that these guys were baby killers, which is offensive on so many levels, because since when do your musical tastes play into what your activities are? And the great irony is, you know, Metallica lyrics have nothing to do with satanic worship. They're anti-authoritarian, but it has nothing to do with devil worshiping. But the fact that Damien's love of Stephen King novels, you know, and Jason's love of Metallica were reasons that these guys should be convicted were just, you know, it was just mind-boggling to see.
So, Jason, in having spent 18 years in prison for a crime that you had nothing to do with, and having been railroaded, you know, for a really vicious, hideous crime that still remains, the guilty party still is out there. How do you make up for that time? I mean, are you bitter at all?
I think it would be a worse tragedy if I did come out of this bitter or hateful or resentful, because then that would destroy my ability to enjoy life, enjoy living, you know. I put all that behind me. I put all that to the side and just really enjoy what I'm doing right now. And I developed that practice way earlier, even when I was still in prison, because, you know, no matter where you are, no matter where you're at, you know, you can still find things about your life to enjoy. And people have just been so loving and kind and accepting to me, you know. I mean, I'm traveling around the country, around the world even, you know, and thanking people in person for their letters of support, their prayers, and any hard work and stuff they've done to make it possible, you know, for me to be here today. And, you know, that's what I focus on, you know.
The movie's about the good side and the bad side of America,
right,
isn't it? I mean, doesn't it come down to that in a way?
Yeah. You know, that's another reason why I kind of, like, dedicate, you know, the rest of my life to, you know, stopping things like this from happening to other people. I'm starting college in April. I hope to work towards getting a law degree and going to law school if my grades are good enough. Let's hope they are, right? And to maybe prevent something like this from happening to another teenager, or help another teenager or grown man who was a teenager, you know, get out of this, you know, in similar situations. You know, so, you know, life is a beautiful thing. Life is great. And the sad thing is tragedy and bad things happen to good people, and they happen all over the world. But what was so miraculous and spectacular is that in this case, Joe and Bruce were able to get down there and capture it on film so people could see it. And so many people came galvanized and motivated to help in any way they can, whether it's throwing gigantic, huge, cool, awesome concerts, or just writing a letter to the representatives of the state of Arkansas saying, hey, we know what you did was wrong. Fix it, you know. So
I have to say, you know, just hanging out with Jason the last couple of months, it's amazing to me how not bitter he is. I have to say, I'm not sure I would have that kind of attitude. I would be really angry and really wanting revenge, just knowing me. So I'm quite impressed with what he has done with this experience. It's obviously not a good thing that he was put in prison, but he has seen, you know, he has figured out how to, you know, get the silver lining out of it. And I have a lot of faith that we're going to be hearing from Jason quite a bit in the coming years.
Well, but you got to feel good about what you've done, Joe, and your partner Bruce.
Yeah, no, look, you're
an accidental crusader in a sense, right?
You just
started to do a film.
Yeah, well, I would say we were an accidental crusader at the beginning, and then the second and third film were clearly acts of advocacy, because from a filmmaking standpoint, revisiting this grisly material again and again, you know, was not something I would choose from purely a cinematic standpoint. Look, you know, I'm in a business where you rarely see such tangible results. I had an extraordinary extreme over the last year, you know, bookended by, you know, I was sued last year by Chevron over my movie Crude, and kind of whacked over the head with the might of the third largest corporation in America, and started questioning whether or not it was a good idea had I made Crude, because it was getting me in such hot water. And that was, you know, when you start to question whether or not you should have made a film, you know, that goes to the core of who you are. And to have it bookended, you know, I think the greatest moment I've ever had in my career, and we've been doing this for a long time now and have had some great moments, was at the New York Film Festival in October. At the end of the movie, we all stood up, meaning Jason, Jesse, and Damien Echols, me and Bruce, and Sheila Nevins from HBO, and we got this rousing standing ovation. And I know the standing, you know, it was like a 10-minute ovation, you know, maybe a half a minute was for the movie, but most of the ovation was for the situation and for these guys. And that was just one of the most touching moments that I think I've ever had in my career. So to have that happen in the same year that I got clobbered by a major corporation was, you know, was especially gratifying.
Well, I thank you for joining us here, Joe Berlinger, and along with your filming partner, Bruce Sanofsky, you've made this extraordinary film, Paradise Lost 3 Purgatory. It's going to premiere Thursday night on HBO, and of course, it's been a tremendous pleasure to have you, Jason Baldwin, one of the West Memphis Three, in the studio with us here today.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for the opportunity.
And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.